The Education Gadfly Show starts now. Hello, today is January 25th, 2007, and this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who owns a lawnmower that actually is powered by the very grass it cuts, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
How are you, Rick?
I'm doing good.
Good, good, good. You going to help out in this goal of reducing our oil consumption by 10%?
Apparently. I like this lawnmower. It's particularly ironic given that, you know, me and Joe live in that condo.
That's right.
We don't really have that much use, but I'm digging it.
Nothing on the patio even? You don't even try to grow some grass out there?
You know, we don't have a single living thing in there. I brought home flowers last night.
Ooh, that's a nice touch,
there was
Rick.
Like a tulip and there was some fancy stuff in there.
You're a romantic guy.
Because she doesn't like roses. Did you know this?
No, I didn't know that.
She's always like, don't get me roses. Get me like other flowers. So I get other flowers.
Why doesn't she like roses? They're just cliche or something?
I never asked.
Yeah. I found that most women don't like carnations.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's because it reminds him of that instant breakfast drink.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So do you, you know, you brought her some flowers for a romantic night, and then you cuddled up and watched the State of the Union?
For a romantic State of the Union night. Yeah. We made chili dogs, and we watched Bush, and it was so they had the wrong person on screen for Spelling's big glory shot. Huh?
That's right. The president talks about education. They go to show Margaret Spelling's, and they pick another woman in a pink dress instead.
Who was the other woman? Do we know?
I don't know. Some member of Congress. I don't know. But you know, if she had worn her bright pink dress from last year, I don't think they would have had as hard a time finding her.
You know who looked good in the outfit she wore was Madam Speaker.
Really?
Nancy Pelosi did not look like a grandma to me.
But you know, she kind of, her eyes were bugging out, and she was kind of, you know, pursing her lips. Wasn't that kind of annoying to you?
Well, I mean, she was sitting next to the vice president, who himself.
Right.
I mean,
was he alive last night? I mean, did he make any motion whatsoever?
Yeah, I think he was goosing her every so often, so that's why her eyes were bugging. Right. But no, man, that haircut, and she's an attractive woman.
All right. Well, Jen is telling us it's time to start talking education policy.
Liam thinks she's an attractive woman.
So, listeners, let us know if you think that Madam Speaker is an attractive woman. Send us a note at letters@edexcellence.net. We would love to hear from you. We're going to get going. We'll start with our game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with Chris Swanson from Education Week. He's going to try to defend our attack on their quality counts.
And he's going to defend the attack, or he's going to defend quality accounts against the attack.
Thank you for that correction.
That's what I'm here for.
You are good. You are on today.
Hey, baby. And actually, I thought you were going to use the word riposte, or how do you pronounce that? Which,
you know,
is a
Rick,
good word.
We do have a suggestive script on the show, but sometimes it's okay to just ad lib.
Yeah, but you miss the good word sometimes.
Yes.
Not that I know how to produce it.
Exactly. And finally, in-house weirdo Liam will keep our humor fresh and safe from decay with some education news of the weird. So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Three topics, 90 seconds each. Jen.
All right. Topic one. As you know, President Bush has released his proposal for NCLB reauthorization. Mike, did W get it right?
Well, you know, it's not bad. It is definitely not the bold rethinking of the law that I would have preferred and that I've been calling for lately. But, you know, if you're going to have a proposal that's about fixing the current law, this is pretty good. It addresses a lot of the law's shortcomings.
Which parts do you like, Mike?
All right. So I like that it allows a growth model. All states can use a growth model as long as they meet certain conditions.
Including the 2014 nonsense.
Well, that is true.
Which means it's not a useful growth model.
Well, perhaps that. But I think it does mean that, you know, it's going to allow at least schools that are making dramatic gains to get credit for that. Under the law, which is important politically, rhetorically, and otherwise. I also like that it would add science to the AYP ratings, the science testings, which would provide more incentive for schools to pay attention to
now,
science.
Now, just to clarify for folks, now those aren't going to phase in that quick, right? The science needs to count by...
Right. So let's explain. So right now, every state has to test in reading and math, and that gets included in the determination of whether a school has made adequate yearly progress and is a good school or a bad school. Science testing starts next year, but under the current law, it will not count at all. They just have to test. And so the new proposal is to add science to the school rating formula.
And by what year?
I don't know. You know, this is a broad outline, this new proposal they have, 20-pager. It doesn't get into that kind
of
stuff.
Now, would they give science a grade straight to 8, or would they still just give it once in elementary and once in middle school?
They did not mention that either. They just said add it to AYP. There's so much more to talk about. You got to check it out at edexcellence.net.
There you go. And you know, it's given them their proper due. One of the things I like that they did was they raised the collective bargaining issue very explicitly. They raised zero not the loophole on a year five restructured. And they did put some useful initiatives in terms of choice and vouchers in there.
Yeah, exactly. So,
give them the props.
All right, Jen, topic number two.
All right. A recent New Yorker article details the problems that befall students when their failing schools are shut down. The biggest issue is that many of them simply never return to the classroom, even when they're provided many resources to help them continue their educations in a better academic environment. Rick, how do we solve this dilemma?
I don't know. I don't think there is an answer.
Rick, you're supposed to be an education expert. You're supposed to have answers.
Yes.
We're going to kick you out of the guild.
I'm feeling it. I'm feeling it. I mean, this is one of the things. You know, we always want answers and we want solutions to these questions. I mean, I'm not sure there is an answer. There's a lot of lousy schools. Under any conceivable regime, there'll probably be a lot of lousy schools. Trying to zero out lousy schools means you got like this disruption and these interruptions. And kids being kids, some kids probably, you know, are going to not wind up in the new schools you'd like them to be in.
You know, this was an amazing New Yorker story, and it was about the new superintendent in Denver, Bennett, who used to be a businessman and now is taking over the system. And he realizes he had this high school that was just an awful, awful school, and he decided to close it. And they tell the story of some of the kids, you know, that try to find their way. A couple of them end up in an online charter school, which was, you know, basically just teaching very basic skills, trying to help them get their high school diploma. And by the end of the story, you just had no idea whether they were going to end up making it or not.
Yeah. I mean, the answer's got to be, look, the goal's got to be, can we get more of these kids into better schools than they're currently in? So if by shutting down a failing school, you can either replace it with a school which is going to deliver a better education to a lot of these kids, or it's going to give you a way to get a lot of these kids into better schools, that's a win. This notion that we're going to find a way to serve the needs of every single kid, you know, it's a nice fantasy, but it just ain't a serious thing to build policy around.
I will say, Rick, it's easy as a pundit to talk about that tough love, but the superintendent, when he shut down the school, was called a latter-day reincarnation of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, actually, I think it's not. I think the easier rhetorical line is to talk about how much you love each and every child, that it's, in fact, you know, these are the kinds of things I say that get me all my hate mail.
You like your hate mail, though, don't you?
Yeah, you know, it gives me something to, you know, put on the wall.
Okay, Jen, third topic.
All right. Kids who can't attend school because of serious illness now have a way to be included in their former classrooms as a robot. Pebbles technology makes it possible for the faces of these youngsters to appear as the face of a robot. Kids control the robot from home, answering questions, turning in homework, taking tests, and for only $70,000 in taxpayer money. Mike, how much should we pay to make sure students feel included?
You know, I just don't understand why people think we're spending too much money on those few kids with those Uber disabilities. Yeah. Look, I actually had a personal experience with this in high school.
Uh-huh.
I had a serious illness, which can go unnamed, and I spent quite a lot of time at home. And I still don't think I would necessarily have wanted a robot Mike to be going to the Parkway West High School for me. It seems like an awful lot of money just to make kids feel included. I mean, you know, it seems like they can do their homework at home and send in their tests.
Oh, it's not just to feel included. I mean, how are you going to get your homework into the teacher? How are you going to take a test if you're not a robot?
Via email, right?
Hello? Is that really the same thing, emailing your homework, as having your robot go get on the bus, go sit at your desk and hand it in?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it's a qualitatively different educational experience, I would argue.
Is that an educational experience?
And how about the dance? Who's going to take your best girl to the sock hop?
Well, your robot, as it turns out, I had to miss a dance in high school, mm-hmm, because I was so sick, the King of Hearts dance. And my date, you know, could have been with the robot, I guess.
You could have been doing the robot.
Doing the robot dance. Like, you're
but,
right.
You know, here's the question then. So if you have your robot then go and spike the punch with, you know, a quart of tequila.
Right.
And the robot gets busted. Are you now culpable even though you're miles away at home with your little remote control?
I don't think so. And furthermore, would the robot, you know, get drunk on that punch?
What if they got a metal detector at the school? Do they have to allow your robot in?
See, that's an excellent question. I mean, with zero tolerance, I think this whole debate is moot. All right. Well, thank you, Rick, for a nice game of Pardon the Gadfly.
Why, thank you, Mike.
All right. Well, it is time for our weekly interview, this time with Chris Swanson at Education Week. Let us take a listen. We're here today with Chris Swanson, who is the director of the Editorial Projects and Education Research Center, best known for Education Week's annual report, Quality Counts, which is what we're going to talk about today. Chris, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
So, Chris, you have a rebuttal in this week's Education Gadfly Show to a piece that we ran a few weeks ago criticizing Quality Counts and its Chance for Success Index. We talked about that on the show a few weeks ago as well. And what we said at the time was that basically we thought this index was claiming that demography was destiny, that it was giving states that had a lot of wealthy kids high scores and giving kids at states that had a lot of poor kids low scores in terms of their students having a success to get a good education. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your defense? Why do you think this report is more than a demography is destiny index?
Yeah, well, thanks, Mike. Well, you know, the first thing is to say that we do not think demography is destiny, and this is an issue that's come up a lot. We've talked to the press and talked to other researchers and folks in the policy community. What we are trying to get at with this report, which is different than what we've done in the past, so we are shifting emphasis, is looking at connections between K-12 education and what happens before and what happens after. So in part, what we want to think about is early foundations in the home, you know, in which case a lot of what we're thinking about is demographic, if you want to think about it that way. It's parents' education or family income. And then after you get through K-12 schooling and on to post-secondary, you know, you start looking at the labor force, and the question there is, you know, can you make good on a good education? And again, you know, you might see those outcomes as being demographic or economic, in this case, employment levels, education level of the workforce.
Okay. So well, let's dig in on this a little bit. Let's talk about the early childhood indicators, first of all. So the basic premise is that, you know, states that have lots of poor kids, it's less likely that those kids are going to be ready for school, which there is plenty of research that says that. All right, but let's imagine you've got two different states, one with lots of poor kids, one with lots of middle-class kids. And both of those states get equal outcomes when it comes to their K through 12 education system. So that means the state, the poor state is doing a phenomenal job either through pre-K programs or what's going on in the schools in getting their kids up to speed. And yet under your index, they actually lose points for having so many poor kids in pre-K. So isn't that backwards?
Well, you know, I guess the first thing is I'm not sure we can find good examples of that hypothetical. We can find examples of, you know, low-performing state, kind of demographically challenged states, if you want to put it that way, that have, you know, maybe average or a little bit above average school systems, and those that have poor school systems. It's very hard probably to find, you know, kind of, say, rich states, poor states that both have high-performing schools. You know, but I think one of the issues here is we don't want to judge schools unfairly. And so it's not all about demographics, certainly. And we do look at school performance, both in the Chance for Success and in the separate index we have. But it's also the case that states are dealing with these issues. States that have a socioeconomically disadvantaged population, schools that do, you know, as well, you know, face different challenges than other types of school systems.
Right, right. No, I think we're totally in agreement, yeah. Chris. It's just that those states seem to get penalized because their index score ends up being lower than similar, you know, than richer states with equal outcomes. Well, all right, let's talk about at the adult education level. Now, you know, you make this case that, you know, employment and income is one indicator that, you know, that adults are able to take advantage of the education system and getting good outcomes. But that assumes that everybody stays within the same state where they went to school. I mean, I grew up in Missouri. I live in Maryland and I work in the District of Columbia. You know, who should get credit for the fact that I have a good paying job?
I think what we're trying to get at with the economic indicators in adulthood, for example, is not so much if you, you know, if a person did grow up in a state and stayed there the whole time, what would happen to that individual person? We're thinking about the economic opportunities in the state. So if you're a state policymaker, you know, you can try to attract talent to a state or you could try to home grow it. And so what we're looking at here is, you know, things like, you know, the education level of the adult workforce, regardless of where they got their education, that's a good indicator of the types of opportunities there are in the labor market, higher paying jobs, more stable knowledge industry versus, you know, declining manufacturing employment.
Yeah, example. But again, that seems to be more about the economy than about education. Chris,
it is about the economy. And actually, that's one of the points, right, that we're trying to get at in this report. You know, it's okay to think about how the schools perform, and, you know, that's valuable to know in and of itself. But if we, especially for policymakers, that's not the end-all and be-all of their existence. You know, they want to think about, you know, how we're serving young kids, because that does factor into how the schools perform and the challenges they face, and also policymakers or other, you know, leaders with a broader portfolio than just education need to also think about the ways that, you know, K-12 schools feed onto higher education and K-12 schools feed onto the labor market. And so the fact that we're having this conversation about demographics on the one end and kind of mobility and employment on the other end, I think is great, because it does point in the direction that, you know, I think we're trying to encourage people to think about, which is, you know, opening up the box a little bit and thinking about K-12, not just about what happens inside the schoolhouse walls.
Well, maybe. But as Rick said, by that measure, the United States must have the best education system in the world because, you know, our economic outcomes are so strong. Chris, have you read this book by Bob Woodward? I think it's called A State of Denial.
I have not.
No, just teasing with you, Chris. All right. Well, thank you for your eloquent defense. We're still a little bit skeptical here at the Education Gadfly, but we look forward to your effort next year, and we appreciate you coming on the show.
And we always enjoy the viewpoints of skeptics.
Okay. Thanks so much. Again, Chris Swanson, the director of the Editorial Projects and Education Research Center, head of Quality Counts, about the Chance for Success Index.
So, Mike, did Chris address your concerns?
I got to say, Rick, I really don't think so. You know, I mean, Liam, you should hop in here because he wrote the original Gadfly piece attacking this thing. I don't think Chris really had any rebuttal at all.
No, I don't think so. I mean, let me just say that I am sure that Chris Swanson is so much smarter than me.
Well, that
I
is,
can't even conceive it.
That's faint praise.
It is definitely, but it is.
Just seemed like you know, we could have gotten this information out of on Wikipedia or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's really no good answer to this question about people moving across state borders. You know, I mean, you didn't have really an answer for that. And the pre-K stuff, you didn't really have an answer for that either. I mean, and to say, well, this is the best data we can get to look at cradle to career. I mean, I understand the importance of looking at cradle to career, but if this is the best data we have, maybe you just don't do this report.
Well, what about the notion that you're old-fashioned, wanting to focus on learning that's taking place within K-12?
Right. I mean, look, I don't have a problem with them saying we should look beyond just K-12. That's okay. But, you know, then do it the right way. You know, do it in a rigorous way. And definitely don't create an impression that some state's doing a great job in education, because this is gets spun as an education report. If actually what they're doing is they're doing a good job with job growth in their economy, which is something else.
Mm.
All right. Well, I don't know. Be curious what listeners think, but I just don't know why Quality Counts went in this direction.
Hey, but I like the equal time. You had them on.
That's right.
You had the conversation.
We are fair and balanced here, Rick.
Although, I don't know, this Woodward line, you kind of dropped it. Right, yeah. Out of the blue on him, huh?
Yeah, well.
Boom, you're a tough guy.
I am a tough guy.
You're kind of like that Mike Wallace when he used to do his sneak interviews, jump out of the coat room at people.
You think that was a sneak interview with Clinton? You're just a bubble lover, aren't you?
When did he interview Clinton?
Well, you know, remember a couple months ago? Wasn't that, was that Wallace? Was that somebody else?
I wasn't really thinking of that. I was thinking like back like in the 80s when he
Mike Wallace. I'm thinking of the Fox guy.
Oh, Chris
guy.
Wallace.
Chris Wallace.
No, I'm thinking like when Mike Wallace used to like go assault like used car dealers after like watching them jip people.
All right. It is now time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam. Liam, what is weird this week?
Students in Hong Kong take two exams during their seven-year stints in secondary school. And if they want to continue on to a university, they have to pass both. So after-school exam tutoring is big business in Hong Kong, and because almost all tutoring providers can boast top academic instruction, they've turned to other means to one-up their competitors, having the hottest tutors. Ken Ng is the head of Modern Education, one of Hong Kong's largest tutoring agencies. Of two of his top tutors, Angela Yu and Stella Cheng, Ng says, quote, "Their long legs are the most beautiful ones in the tutorial industry. This is our selling point," unquote. And indeed, Yu and Cheng have their own promotional campaign for which they met with photographers and fashion stylists before settling on mini skirts and high heels for their promotional pictures. Rick, did you ever have a tutor?
Whew, I got it. Now, do you pay a premium if you – 'cause if I signed up with Modern Education and then I was being tutored by some guy named Albert – I would feel gypped. I mean, how do you make sure that you actually get FaceTime with Angela or Stella?
Yeah, this is true. But isn't – and if you do get FaceTime with them, isn't that kind of distracting? I mean, wouldn't you actually get a lower score because you're not concentrating on your studies?
Mm. Well, and what does this say about choice-based reform, Mike?
I don't know, but why I'm more curious about what it says about national standards. I mean, if we had this kind of test in this country, I mean, what would that mean for the tutoring business here?
So – what would it mean? that we would be recruiting girls off the runways to
I don't know. I mean, what I want to know is Jen, I mean, do you find this to be just terribly sexist and demeaning all around?
Well, if they're equal opportunity, then I don't have a problem with it. But I didn't see any mention of hot guy tutors either. So
this is a very good point. So, you know, and I assume that in Hong Kong that there are plenty of women that are trying to go on to these higher education.
Now, this is a good point because I never had a tutor, but I did tutor at Brandeis. And in fact, part of my outreach – I used to tutor particularly economics. And part of my portfolio to recruit tutees was there was a particular picture of me draped – over a beach blanket looking soulful in sunset, which I think was very effective at realizing
market share. Did enrollment drop at that point?
Oh, goodness, no.
And Rick, I do have to ask, did you ever date any of your tutees?
No, my roommates kept doing it, though. It created a real problem on sustained market share.
And something else that those people in Hong Kong are going to have to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Liam. It's that was, you know, mildly weird. You'd think that was pretty weird.
Hey, are you guys going to post a picture of Angela and Stella on the Fordham website so that people are fully informed about these developments?
I think that's a good idea.
I couldn't find one.
On the podcast. You couldn't find one?
I couldn't find one. And I searched for Modern Education's website and still couldn't find one.
Jeez. Is that right? And they don't have a MySpace page or anything?
Didn't search MySpace. Maybe you can log on to your MySpace
account. It's not that aggressive a marketing campaign then, is it?
All right. Well, we've probably bored you to death by now. That is all the time that we have for the Education Gadfly Show. Thank you, Liam and Jen and Rick. I was going to give you your chance to do your I'm Rick Hess thing.
I know.
I didn't forget about you.
I didn't know whether to thank Kobe or not. Kobe's sitting here, but he was silent.
Well, there is Kobe. That's right.
Kobe say hi, Mom, or something, bud.
Peace.
That was weak.
That was, yeah, all right. Well, Kobe, the man behind the madness. All right. Well, everybody, don't forget to check us out on edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.